foes, they're in business together. Daddy Bush knows the Carlyle Group, since years before, been raking in billions and itching for more.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link.
They say code war,
we say code pink.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link. They say code war,
we say code pink.
Code pink for freedom, code pink for peace. Was not Iraq, but Iran.
They feed you lies, don't want you to think.
They say code terror,
we say code pink.
They feed you lies, don't want you to think. They say code terror,
we say code pink.
Code pink for freedom, code pink for peace, code pink till hunger and war have ceased.
That was Code Pink by Emma's Revolution. I am Julia Norman of Code Pink. Welcome to our Code Pink radio show, presented by WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, WPFM 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, and many other community radio stations like Western Massachusetts Community Broadcasting, WMCBP LP 107.9 FM. We are also on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Check out our website at codepink.org/radio, where you will find all of our latest episodes from episode one to most recent. I am so excited to welcome our listeners today for a conversation on advocacy across decades. Often when we think about who's actively involved in social and political activism, or who's leading social justice movements, we may tend to think of younger generations. Anti-war and civil rights movements have strong ties to college campuses. And there's a lot of attention being drawn to Students for Justice in Palestine at this current moment and their suppression. And while certainly I'm a student myself, there's no doubt that younger generations play a role in bringing about social change. It seems like the role of retirees or mothers or grandmothers, those in their most wise years of life, are often overlooked. And certainly age is not a determinant for change making. I know in my perspective, those in older generations see change over time and have helped me place what's going on in Gaza in a broader historical context. They continue to give their lives and expertise to crafting a better world, serving as mentors and leaders and helping pave the way for a new generation of activists. And so with me today, I have two such individuals, Paki Wieland and Mona Sadek. They are both officially retired from salaried work. Both are mothers. Paki Wieland is a grandmother, and they remain ever committed to fighting for a more just world. We've all crossed paths in our individual efforts to end the genocide in Gaza, and I hope to explore their decades of advocacy with them today. Before I let them introduce themselves, I just want to tell the viewers a little bit about them, because they are incredibly impressive women. Paki Wieland is a lifetime political activist who worked for over 20 years as a family therapist and academic, teaching in the Department of Applied Psychology at Antioch University in New Hampshire, and as an adjunct professor at Smith College and Springfield College in Massachusetts. She's participated in 7 human rights delegations to conflict zones, including one of the flotillas attempting to raise awareness to the blockade in Gaza. She has protested the war in Vietnam, Iraq, nuclear power plants, Wall Street's abuse of the economy, the Dakota Access Pipeline Project, the Trump administration, and much more. Welcome, Paki, to the Code Pink radio show.
Oh, thank you.
And last but certainly not least, we have here Mona Sadek, a self-described Palestinian Arab American Muslim woman who's been actively involved and supportive of several nonprofit organizations throughout her life. She earned her BA from Lebanese American University and her MBA from George Mason University, and built a career working in the private and public sector in finance and accounting. In 2015, she helped found the National Arab American Women's Association as treasurer and then president. And in 2020, Mona became the executive director of the American Palestinian Women's Association. She is a current board member of the Muslim Women's Association. Thank you for joining us, Mona.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, I know that was a long introduction, but before we jump into questions, I'd love to have you guys both introduce yourself to the viewers, just letting us know where you're joining us from and how you are connected to Code Pink. Paki, we'll start with you.
All right. I'm Paki Wieland, and I live in Western Massachusetts. We have our Code Pink chapter here, and one of our big things is the annual International Women's Day event. But we take part in all the good trouble we and all of our collaborators engage in here in the Valley, where there are five activist colleges here, and they always give us something to do and the opportunity to raise our voices for justice. And of course, with Palestine right now, I'll just tell you a quick thing. Smith College, which is one of our local schools, up to 50 students sat in for 2 weeks, and they were not expelled. They had ongoing dialogue with the president and other members of the board, and they've left their occupying, but they have moved onto the lawn of one of the halls. And on this coming Sunday, we're going to be it's a town meeting that they've invited not only the campus community, but the towns and local people to come and engage. And the other thing we're doing is in all of our cities and towns, we are passing ceasefire resolutions. And when people do that, we're all energized to do that. And so what I've been pushing is for people to do what we did in DC, and that is to look at where the investments are, and Mona, we can talk. I'd love to hear more about that, but to get the cities to divest their pension funds from war making, and if we could do it in D.C., which we did, and they can do it in New York, we can certainly do it in Northampton and Greenfield, Massachusetts. So those are some of the things, and I had the wonderful pleasure of meeting you last week, so in D.C. So. Good energy.
Thank you.
And Mona, can you introduce yourself to the listeners, where you're coming from and how you started working or joining us with Code Pink?
Yeah, actually, I live in Virginia, and I've been here in the United States since 1990. I used to live in Kuwait, and due to the Gulf War, I moved with my kids to Virginia, and we have been living here since then. And for me, I mean, I used to work for profit, but all of a sudden I have this passionate for the last 10 years, 15 years, where I feel like I'm not interested in making money as much as really working and supporting any peace movements, any such human rights. And I was so lucky to meet Code Pink, to meet Madea, and know their mission, what they are doing. And I love what they are doing. And of course, out of my, you know, being part of, you know, we co-founded the NAWA, National Arab American Woman Association. I was one of the co-founders. And then I moved to be the president of American Palestinian Women's Association. And also, I am on the board of Muslim Women Association, and all of these, you know, organizations. And even at one time, I was a Arab America Foundation Virginia team leader, and all of these organizations, they support, of course, we support peace, and always we try to voice out, you know, our concern about the human rights. And for me, I mean, this is actually where I come from, you know. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Mona. It's a pleasure to
You're
have
welcome.
It's really I am a student for the viewers. I've just started with Code Pink a few months ago to just respond to what's been going on in Gaza. I'm based in DC, and I have had the pleasure of getting to meet the most incredible women who have all become mentors for me these past few months, with you both included. So thank you both for joining. Today we're really going to be talking about your activism and advocacy, but these things can mean different things to different people. So I'd love for you each to kind of share, what does activism or advocacy mean to you? And Mona, I'll ask you first. When you hear those things, what is that?
Okay, activism, and it's like to show your concern about things that you really touch you and concern you. And of course, I mean, from where I'm coming, I mean, it's always focusing at humanitarian causes and advocacy. I feel like because being Palestinian and we see the oppression of our people, and of course I mean, the organizations I am affiliated with, they have nothing to do with politics. It has something to do with human nature, human causes. And that's where I don't know, I mean, just to share with you more about it, about American Palestinian Women's Association. Our mission before October 7 was different. I mean, we were helping, we had a program on the ground back in the refugee camps where we help autistic children. But since October 7, we saw the suffering of Gaza. We saw the oppression. We saw what's going on there. And we felt like there is something wrong. There is a lost link, or what you say, there is something missing. We as a taxpayer, we pay our taxes in this country, okay? We pay to make our voice heard. And to let our voice reach to our lawmakers, okay? And then why should we put ourselves in whatever is going on and affecting our international abroad relationship for what? Why we should be affiliated with genocide act? You see, why we're putting our self and our tax money in that corner? I mean, so whatever we see in Gaza, it's indescribable. I mean, we cannot describe what's going on. For me, as a mother, I cannot imagine my children will have this suffering. So I cannot believe that somebody who's in power can sustain, or not sus I mean abstain, or we can say just they can use their power to prevent the reaching of humanitarian aids to these people. Helpless. They are helpless. They have nothing to do with what's going on. We justify killing these people. We're sitting watching what's going on. I mean, it's unbelievable. So I felt like what Code Pink is doing, amazing. We're lobbying. We're going, we are there every day in the Congress, try to be there with Code Pink in the Congress, in the Senate, voicing out our concern for ceasefire, for acting, in a humanitarian way. We're asking the officials, just stand up and say ceasefire, do something to help these hopeless, people. I don't know what to say. I mean,
No, thank you so much for sharing that. I share in your devastation, but I know that this is so personal for you as well. And What I have been hearing too, what you just touched on, and what I think is really powerful in terms of advocacy at this moment, is this consciousness that there are a few people in power who are using our tax dollars and their votes to allow these things to continue. And that part of what we can do is to demand to hold them accountable and to express that that is not the way that we'd like our government to be using our money, investing its time. And we're certainly right now this week in the midst of seeing, will we send another $14 billion to Israel? So, you know, advocacy in civic engagement, I think, is so vital at this time. And that's certainly been a re-education for me about how conscious I need to be about who is my elected representative.
Exactly right. Yeah.
So Paki, I'll go over to you. You know, anything you want to touch on from what was just shared, and also just, you know, what does activism and advocacy mean to you? Because you certainly have had a lifetime of activism in all different capacities.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you, Mona, for telling us that part of the story, and I couldn't agree with you more. You know, when you think about what we're watching, what we are actually witnessing in people's lives and in people's stories, it's unfathomable that that our Congress has such stone hearts that they are not moved. I am heartened, because I think for a long time there seemed to be us oldies who remembered earlier wars protesting, and especially with the young JVP people, with young Palestinians, and certainly even here, and with the Students for Justice in Palestine. I am so moved by them, by all of you young people who are really leading the way, and I'm so impressed with your care, not only about the issues, but about one another and even yourselves, that I love following you. So I'm very glad that you're here, taking these positions, taking leadership. I mean, I think what activism means to me is it's really walking the walk. I grew up in the apartheid South and learned early on about living with and witnessing injustice and being moved, particularly by people in my school, in my community, who knew it was wrong and stood up. So there was a man who wrote for the Times who grew up in Mississippi, and he wrote about himself being a reconstructed Southerner. And this was back probably in the 70s. And I really grabbed onto that and thought, yes, that's what we are. We're reconstructed Southerners. But I think having witnessed pain and suffering in my young years, and seeing that there were breakthroughs, there were ways to get beyond it, and witnessing the civil rights movement and the anti-war movements, that are so encouraging. And I want everybody to know that we win. You know, when I spoke with some of the students who were occupying the hall at Smith College, and all I could say to them was, you have already won, because they have stopped business as usual. They have woken people up to seeing what's happening, and people engaged in the conversation. Now that's easier at a progressive college campus than it is in the halls of Congress. That it's extraordinary, and I you know, I come down whenever I can, but the two of you standing there, coming day after day, day in and day out, to do this, I am so in awe of you and so appreciative of the work you're doing, because it's inspiring people. All my friends tune in to what Medea is writing, to what Code Pink is saying, and are encouraged. And so here we are in our communities saying, so what can we do here? And I think it's both, you know, it's what you're doing in DC and what we're doing locally. And we're building momentum for that that wonderful quote of Arundhati Roy, you know, we know another world is possible and we are on our way to create it. And I look at your beautiful faces and say, yes, we're all on our way to create it. So I'll stop there for that answer to activism. It does mean walking the walk. And let me just say this. I think whatever people are doing, there's some people who are writers, there are some people who can go out and take the stand, and there are people who have to do other things, that I think one of the ways that we're creating this new world is to realize that there isn't a hierarchy, that if I'm willing to get arrested, it's not necessarily any better than your doing the radio program, which is so good to get out to people, or the work you're doing, Mona, that each of these is all part of the mosaic, and that's how we are creating this new world. And so I'm just delighted to be with both of you. And now
yeah,
I will
thank
stop.
You. Yeah, just let me add something here. Of course, I mean, everybody fights from a different perspective. It doesn't mean that if I raise up my concern, voice out my concern, it means I might be get arrested, because we are here, we are practicing our First Amendment. So our right to speak up, you know, to speak out and voice out our concern. And, you know, being raised up in this country, the country which gives freedom, justice, you know, and we are so proud. I mean, I remember when we decided to come to the States 35 years ago as an immigrant to the United States, I was so happy, proud to be part of this multicultural, you know, community of this strong, strong image, you know, of being American, because it's so honored to be, you know, to feel part of a country where they are calling for justice. They are not siding with one country at this time, and, you know, doing double work or, you know, I mean, whenever you think about it, it is our right to advocate for our rights, you know, for human rights. It is. That's the way I see it, you know. That's why I'm so proud of being, you know, here in the States, to practice our rights, to advocate for, you know, for human rights. And it's, I believe it's one of the countries that they have this advantage. Not every country have the rights to advocate for the rights. I'll stop here.
Thank you so much. I think, you know, what's really inspiring when I'm hearing you both speak is that there seems to be what you're pulling on, and I think that's where I'd like us to start talking about next, is something unique about this moment as well, that just the kind of the suffering that we're bearing witness to demands us, you know, to respond. And I'm sure that that is also the case in every moment in history. I know as a young person, one of the things that I keep asking and trying to reconcile is, you know, where on the timeline of both US history and also just the history of occupation and apartheid and the blockade and the conflict in the region, you know, how did we get to such a point of what seemed like Israel being able to act with total impunity and us bearing witness to human rights violations and atrocities that I know that I have never seen. And so I would like to actually pose to each of you, you know, Mona, you have really worked in this kind of advocacy space in terms of organizations. Paki, you have also worked with many organizations. You've worked abroad. You've done, when we were talking about arrests, you know, you've also been in that activist space of disruption, trying all these different avenues. What do you feel, if at all, is different about this time? Do you find it analogous to maybe, you know, wars in Iraq or Vietnam, or other things you've been through and witnessed? Or what is it about this genocide that is occurring in real time that demands a different type of engagement? And how have you responded to that? And Haki, I'll start with you.
Those are really great questions, and I think, you know, I think there are a couple of ways I can answer this. One is we have more access to information than ever before in the history of the world. I mean, I think about the genocide of the Native American people, of the indigenous people to this continent, and why wasn't there a greater outcry? Where was CNN? Where was the electronic intifada? You know, where were all these? They weren't there. And so people could be farming, they could be doing their commerce, they could be doing whatever and not see what's happening. The other thing is, so I think social media particularly has been very useful. And that leads me to this thought I had when I was talking with a congressman the other day, and I mentioned that the news I had was that that 2 months into the war in Ukraine, the Ukrainians and Russians said, "Wait a minute, this is like what we learned about in World War One. This is the same darn thing. We can't do this again." And the United States, Britain, and probably other forces, but those two particularly, said, "No, no, no, keep." To Zelensky, keep going because we'll have, you know, clean up everything else, including those other parts of what was Russia, what was the Soviet Union. Anyway, and so I knew that, but I knew that because I knew people who had written about it, who had researched it and studied it, and so I think that there are three medias here. There's the ultra conservative Fox News and it's lathering, and then there's the mainstream media that a lot of people pay attention to. Everything from MSNBC to CBS to CNN and PBS, and then there are those of us who find other sources, and that's. Those are the three silos we can find ourselves in. So if I'm watching Democracy Now! Every morning, and you are too, we can talk about that. But people who are watching CNN don't get the same information we do. And so, you know, I mean, I think when I was a kid, when I was young, a kid, when I was young, and the Vietnam War was going on, there were only three networks. And all three of them showed body bags, showed what was actually happening in Vietnam. And they lied, but there was this irrefutable presence of dead people. And, you know, so that was something that really turned a lot of people's heads around. What we're seeing now, as you said, Mona, and both of you have attested to, you know, but it's never been anything quite like this, where we see a child starving to death, and I think, how can you not, you know, want to do anything, you know? And so I think, you know, when you say some of us, you know, will stand up and rage, I think it's something. It doesn't feed the child. It doesn't console the mother whose baby is dying in her arms. You know, and I see that, and I think, what in the hell is going on? How can people buy into the narrative of the goodness of war or the badness of a certain group of people, whoever they are? And so I'm just outraged and want to find ways to make this stop.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I think, you know, I will just say that for me, I am so deeply struck, and the collective grief is certainly something that I think is not, you know, we have to respond first and then think about that later. But it's also so personal. And Mona, I know, for you as a Palestinian American woman, that I mean, I cannot imagine what you are going through. I'm good friends with Taz, who also joins us on our show, and He's lost over 100 members of his family. It's unfathomable. And so I would just, yeah, ask you on a personal note, and then again, in thinking of the context of your life, how is this moment different? And you've touched a bit on how your organizations have responded differently. But just what does this moment demand of you that different periods of time have not?
Just let me say thank you, Becky. You have touched so many important points, like the social media and the effect of the social media on the people. And I can see, just let me highlight, shed the light on these things. The social media, if you want to follow and you are after knowing, you want to know the facts, of course, you will put more efforts to find more and learn more and focus at the news. But what I am seeing that so many people here, so many officials, they close their ears and eyes. They don't want to see what's going on in Gaza, because I don't think any human being who will see these things, they will not be moved. I cannot imagine. I cannot imagine any human being who will see all of these things. And it's not, they didn't make it up. They did, it's not, it's a real videos coming from the ground, from the people in Gaza. It's the news are real. It's not fabricated. It's not making it up. So if I want to seek what's going on, if I want to know more about what's going on, I will try to listen to different news. But if I don't want to, and I want to keep away from what's going on, and this is most of the government officials, what they are doing, they don't want to hear more. So that's why they don't call for ceasefire. That's why they don't care about what's going on there, because if they see all of the suffering, if they see this genocide, if they see every day how many massacres, how many bomb shield on the ground, how many people are getting killed, from children, from mothers, from old men, all of these people are innocent. They didn't do anything, and then they are using the food as a weapon to make people are starving. Can you imagine if we have a pet? We have a pet here. We will take care of our pets here. These are human beings, and nobody's taking care of them. They let them suffer. People are they 700,000 people in North Gaza. They don't have food. They don't have food. If they have a can, six, seven people of the family, six, seven individuals of the family, they use this can for a couple of days. Can you imagine? Can you imagine? Can you hear the scream of the children? I mean, so for us, as American Palestinian Women's Organization, I felt, we diverted from our mission somehow lately to show our concern of our people back home. I mean, none of us can just sit on a table, for dinner without thinking of them. We see all of this food around us. We see the water around us. We feel like we can use, I mean, we can use the bathroom. We can our we can use hygiene things, Today I got a video from people in from Gaza. Women are pleading for help to try to find to provide them with sanitized packages, for women there. Yeah, they don't have access to it. I mean, every day you hear stories, and it's a lot of suffering, and I don't know. I mean, we're trying our best to help.
Thank you so much, Mona. It is It's such a harrowing time, and there really aren't, people say it a lot, but it's because there are not words to capture what's going on. And I think that we are all just doing our best to process what we're seeing and then respond, because it's so desperate, and people whose voices are not being heard, or they're being ignored, which you touch on, obscured, we have to be that voice. So I think at this time we're going to take a break. We'll let people sit with what they've just heard, and then we'll come back. So thank you so much, Mona and Pocky, and to our listeners. You can follow us at codepink.org. You're listening to Code Pink Radio, coming to you through Pacifica Radio's WPFW in Washington, D.C., WBAI in New York City, KPFT in Houston, KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. We will be back after this break to continue with Mona Sadek and Pocky Wieland.
First they'll form a loving circle around the wounded wing. They contain the brutal beasts of war. Sweet freedom songs they'll sing. Sweet freedom songs they'll sing. A lullaby much stronger than bombs and threats to kill. Rock the few who steal the most, and then rule with youthful charms. So they'll see the damage that they do, and will fall into grandma's arms. 2,000 loving arms. If you think these women are too soft to face the world at hand, then you
So that was Holly Near's 1,000 Grandmothers, a source of inspiration for today's program. Welcome back. I am Julia Norman, the DC coordinator at Code Pink. You are listening to Code Pink Radio, presented by WBAI in New York City, WPFW in Washington, D.C., KPFT in Houston, and KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. We're going to jump right back into this fruitful conversation with Pocky and Mona. Thank you guys for being with us. So before the break, we were talking about the horrors going on in Gaza and how that has moved each of you into action, into all kinds of communities, into just a different type of response. And with that, Pocky, I was wondering if you could talk to us about what you're working on right now. With Raging Grannies, the Mother's Day event in DC that's coming up, and what inspired this action? And for those viewers who may not know what I mean when I just said Raging Grannies, if you could also explain a bit about that term and its origin.
Well, about 20 years ago, a little more, maybe close to 25 years ago, a group of women in, I think in Winnipeg, Canada, got together and started the first Raging Granny gaggle. We're not groups, we're gaggles. In 2003, there was a women's peace conference here in Northampton, Mass. And out of it came lots of things. And one of the women who had been in one of the small groups when we were reporting back said, "I hear there's this group called, there's this thing called Raging Grannies. And I think we should start that right here." So 20 years ago, In 2003, 21 years ago now, about eight of us, maybe 12 of us, came together, downloaded the songbook, and started singing. It's we sing old tunes that with new lyrics. One of the things that I was sharing the other day in DC was walking through the halls, particularly in the Russell Building, which has all that marble, and it just reverberates, singing. They're working for peace in the White House. They're kind to the homeless and poor. They generously fund education. They do everything to stop war. And then the refrain is lies, 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 lies. It's all a bundle of lies. And it just reverberates all over. Anyway, those are the kinds of things we do. So Vicky Ryder, who's in North Carolina, is one of the strongest voices for the Raging Grannies. And we had a conversation recently during which she said, wouldn't it be great if we brought, as following that invitation of Holly Dear, if we brought 1,000 grandmothers to Washington to speak out against the war. And so we decided, we got in touch with Medea and Jody Evans, and a few of us had a conversation and decided, yes, we could do it in the lead up to Mother's Day. So on Thursday, the 9th of May, everybody listening, get your little device out and put this down. Thursday, the 9th of May, and Friday, the 10th, 1,000 grandmothers perhaps will be converging on Washington, D.C., meeting at 10 o'clock on Thursday morning in the Rayburn Building, and be join with Code Pink and whatever you all are doing and we're doing to protest the wars. And particularly, there's the whole thing of Mother's Day started with women imploring one another not to send their children to kill other mothers' children. That was before Hallmark, So the we'll honor the legacy of those early women, and be right there to and perhaps do some singing in the halls there. Thursday evening, we'll be doing a participant concert where the different gaggles and also the DC Labor Chorus and Lucy Murphy's chorus and other choruses from the DC area and other performers from the DC area will sing, because that's a big thing that keeps us going. I can be really just really worn out, and we'll start singing. And we did that in Senator Fetterman's office last week, and all of a sudden that sort of 4 o'clock fatigue was just overcome with us singing and encouraging one another. So that's in, please put that in your calendar, you too, and everybody who's
Oh, yeah.
listening. Come to DC the 9th of May, and get in some good trouble with us, and be inspired by the music, and then do some more on Friday, because we understand that the Congress and the Senate will both be in session that Thursday and Friday, which is kind of unusual for Friday. But so do that. And meanwhile, did you just play Send in 1,000 Grandmothers?
That was, yeah, playing for the break.
So remember that, and we grandmothers are a tough bunch to tangle with. So watch out, Congress, we're coming for you.
Thank you so much. I was wondering if you both would be willing to talk to, for the viewers that are, not the viewers, for the listeners that are hearing this right now, and might be inspired by what you've done, might be thinking themselves, I'm heartbroken by what's going on in Gaza, or I've been heartbroken by some of the things that I've been witnessing our elected officials do in all kinds of capacities, but what can I do? I live in California in a small town, and I work full time, or maybe they are retired like the both of you, and they just never thought that activism was something that they've done, and so it feels very new. What advice would you give to them, and what kind of message would you like to leave to those reflecting on how one can participate apart from lobbying Congress, let's say? And Paki, I'll go to you.
Sure, that's again a good question. I think one of the things that we need to do is talk to our friends. That I had a friend years ago who said what her mother used to do was she would sit at the television and throw socks at it when she got so angry. Well, this friend became a raging granny and didn't have to throw socks at the television. I think there's so many things we can do. There is talking to your city councilors, and we have this interesting thing where some city councilors say, wait a minute, this is a national thing. This is an international thing. We're talking about the school budgets. We're talking about the police force. And what we've really reiterated is that the city council, your mayor, those are the closest places that we interface with our government. And so we're asking them to go on record. In fact, what we do is this amazing thing. We invite them to activate their consciences, that if you don't ask your city councilors, you don't ask your mayor to do these things, they don't have the opportunity. So we're doing them a favor by saying, here's your opportunity to be on the right side of history. And so many people are aware. I mean, we hear the statistics, the number of people who want ceasefire in this country, not just Muslim Americans, not just Palestinian Americans, not just old hippies, but there are lots of people. The majority of people want it, and so we give our city councils that opportunity. And the other thing is that then you go to, oh yeah, so if you don't want war, why pay for it? And you say, well, we could take our money, the retirement funds and all of that, and put it in other funds. And I had this idea the other day, because it's tax day, and I thought, if you had a city council in a small town where they could do it, or where you have town meeting that runs things, and you said, what makes you ask people, what makes you secure? It's certainly not bombs. Do bombs make anybody feel secure? Of course not. What makes you secure is knowing you have enough to eat, knowing your children are getting an education, knowing that you have a roof over your head, knowing that you're not going to go in debt if you get sick. So let's really look at, hey, where do we have, where's the Defense Department? How is it working for us? It's not. So we have to just turn that whole narrative around and expose it, because even when you talk to somebody in the service, they don't get anything out of it. It's Raytheon, it's a big those big companies. So anyway, that's a little off, but I think what's really important is continuing to keep community, to keep courage with one another, because if you just go on your own, you could just go mad and just get so angry, and you become futile. It's futile. But when you talk about Mona, when you talk about the women's group, that you're doing good work and you've got each other. And in Code Pink, when we're lobbying, we're doing good work and we've got each other. And it's so it's really building community that is the best resistance.
Much for that. I think that those are such true and important words for people to hear, and that there's so many avenues. I would just stress, like, Code Pink itself has chapters for the viewers all across the country, but also, Mona, you're someone that founded organizations when they didn't exist. So could you, yeah, speak to that point, and just how have you formed community, and what do you think viewers can do apart from lobbying Congress, which Paki just spoke to as well?
I mean, always whenever you come up with an idea and there is a need for it, that's when you start organizing yourself and start an organization or organized group to meet what to meet your, what you're thinking or what you are looking for. And this is the way when we co-founded National Arab American Woman, we felt there is a need for a group of organized women to get together to voice out our concern. And that was one of the reasons for coming up with NAWA. But again, for other organizations, they have been there for 20, 25 years, but just I joined them because I felt it represents me. Arab American, American Palestinian Women's Organization, APWA, it represents me as an American Palestinian woman. And I felt like what they are doing, good causes back home there to help the needy people. This is my passionate about it. But let me touch, I mean, Cam, you mentioned something very important, when we get together, try to go to lobby or advocate for, certain beliefs with the officials. This is something excellent. But my additional advice is that so many people, they just listen to one side of the story. And to listen to one side of the story, it's not right. So my advice actually, you have to listen to the other side of the story. So listening to the other side of the story, then as a rational person, you will decide what's right and what's wrong. I mean, that's the only way, just to advocate for asking people, take, listen to different stories, listen from different sides, and then you will come up with the facts. You will see it yourself if you want to continue on that side or you want to continue on this side. I'm not gonna force you to say or to direct you to some direction. No, just listen to both sides.
Thank you so much, Mona. And I think there's something so powerful about that. That if people just hear the truth, if they get a full sense of what's going on, and it touches to the first part of this episode, how moving this period of time is to just bear witness to the things that are going on in Gaza, the atrocities that people are facing, the real suffering that once you see it, you can't look away. And maybe that is really, there's a quote by Noam Chomsky that I can't, just recall off the top of my head, but it's a longer paragraph in which he talks about the fact that we're all essentially born activists and we forget. And we forget because we get used to our life. We get conditioned, but once you that sense of deep empathy that exists within us is, kind of switched on, there's no going back. Now you're an activist. And that's just nature because we care for other people. So I thank you both so much. I wish we had, more time. I know that the listeners would want more time to hear from you both. But unfortunately, that is all we have for today. So I just really want to thank you guys for taking the time to speak with me, let the listeners hear from your expertise and wisdom. Thank you to all the listeners for tuning in to Code Pink Radio, presented by WBAI in New York City, WPFW in Washington, D.C., KPFT in Houston, and KPFK 90.7 in Los Angeles. We hope to see you next week.
Bush and Bin Laden, you think they're foes? They're in business together. Daddy Bush knows the Carlyle Group since years before been raking in billions and itching for more.
It's blood for oil. We know there's a link.
They say cold war.
We say cold pink.
It's blood for oil. We know there's
We built him up through the CIA. We paid him. We
trained him to be our man. When our enemy was not Iraq, but Iran.
They feed you lies, don't want you to think.
They say code terror,
we say code pink.
They feed you lies, don't want you to think.
They